Liked it. Okay, so we were. It's Halloween, so it's appropriate that the point at which we start is on the Frankenstein problem. We didn't really discuss the Frankenstein problem. Right? We're ready for the Frankenstein problem. This is the second of the four contradictions in the functionality of the state. So here's the basic Frankenstein problem. And there's a certain sense in which I think one might even want to, I haven't really thought this through totally, but one might want to think of neoliberalism as an attempt at killing the Frankenstein, you know, as a response to the Frankenstein problem. So here's the basic point of the Frankenstein problem. It has three basic theses and then a conclusion. Thesis one, which has to do with the underlying logic of capitalism. The underlying logic of capitalism means that capitalism has deeply self-destructive tendencies. If left to its own devices, capitalism just makes a mess of things. It cannot control its own contradictions. The financial crisis is just one instance of that. Capitalism has self-destructive tendencies. This means there is a functional necessity for what Offa calls flanking systems. That is, there's an absolute functional need for some kind of system to be in place on the flanks, you know, to prevent these contradictions from destroying the system itself. This means that the state must intervene to prevent capitalism from destroying itself economically. Which means the state has to have the capacity for intervention. A state with no capacity for intervention cannot block these self-destructive tendencies. So the state must be given enough power and competence to be able to intervene into the functioning of a capitalist economy. That's the first thesis. Second thesis is the state also needs autonomy from manipulation by particular interests of specific capitalists in order for this capacity to be used for the interests of the system as a whole. These functional requirements are unlikely to be provided. The right kinds of interventions are unlikely to be provided if the state is in the pockets of powerful capitalists. It's not that it's impossible. You could have some powerful, you know, cabal of capitalists who are very far-sighted and concerned about the interests of capitalism as a whole rather than just their own wealth and accumulation. But generally speaking, the state needs a certain degree of real autonomy from manipulation in order to use this power it has in the optimal way. So the first thesis is a kind of thesis about how much power the state needs. It needs interventionist power. Not just repressive power to block class struggles, it needs interventionist power to regulate and organize capitalism. And the second one is it needs autonomy. And the third thesis is the Frankenstein problem. Putting these things together means the state needs enough autonomy to use its capacity in the interests of capital, but it turns out that the amount of autonomy that it needs to do that also enables it to do harm to capitalism. That is, you create a monster that you don't necessarily control. The interventionist capacity of the state gives it a capacity to redistribute way beyond what's necessary for stability, gives it a capacity to redistribute in ways that is desired by popular forces. It gives it a capacity to intervene to regulate environmental destruction way beyond what's needed just for the security of capitalism. It gives it a capacity to do that in the interests of health and well-being of people on the planet. The Frankenstein problem is therefore a real contradiction. The capitalist class and the capitalist system needs a powerful state to regulate the economy independently of the manipulations of individual capitalists, but such a state is a potential monster. It has a capacity to intervene in ways that goes against the interests of capital. Creating a monster you can't control, that's the Frankenstein metaphor. To be able to autonomously intervene functionally, it must have a capacity to do so destructively. Now, you know, that's a pretty interesting fact of a system, that in order for it to behave functionally, it has to also be able to be destructive. Now, the fantasy would be you could just sort of so finely tune it that the amount of power needed to be functional and the autonomy needed to be functional didn't allow this destructive aspect. It just turns out that's not the case, that the amount of power you have to give the state and the amount of autonomy you have to give it in order for it to do these things well also crosses a threshold where it can do harm. So one way of thinking about neoliberalism in these terms was in the 60s and 50s, gradually there was an accumulation of power in the state, and not just in the US, but in Europe and elsewhere, in which the state was increasingly acting in ways that were serving legitimation purposes, popular interests, that were using this interventionist capacity in ways that put constraints on capital beyond what was necessary for stable capitalism, putting constraints on capital that was actually benefiting large segments of the population in ways that was suboptimal for capitalism. And the neoliberal attack was an attack to basically dismantle this capacity. If you take a kind of pendulum swing view of this thing, the neoliberal attack wanted to destroy this capacity and this autonomy because of the dangers it posed, but it could only do so by going too far. There was no solution that creates a stable, low-capacity state, because that is also not functional for capitalism. In the height of the economic crisis of 3 or 4 years ago, you know, in 2009, let's say, when things were really out of control, there was a pretty widespread view, which turned out to be false, that that was the end of neoliberalism, that there, you know, neoliberalism had gone too far. Now the time for reconstructing state capacity to intervene and regulate was needed, because we've seen what happens when you have this kind of extreme deregulation. And really, one of the striking and somewhat puzzling things about this crisis is how little has changed, and how the previous ideological configuration that dominated policy formation in the 90s and 2000s has come back, if anything, with a bit of a vengeance. You know, it's not quite so simple as to say nothing has changed, but you know, the austerity policies, the idea that that state regulations hamper the market, I mean, all this stuff is back in force without, and people are spout this stuff without embarrassment. You know, gurus and political actors. Yeah.
Well, I'm just curious, one thing that really puzzles me about neoliberalism is that it's not so much that it's a Frankenstein as it's like a cannibalistic Frankenstein, that it's actually the state is eliminating itself to function. Like, it seems like that's a layer of complexity that I don't really understand.
Well, the neoliberalism is the Frankenstein killer. Neoliberalism is the mob that wants to kill Frankenstein because it's out of control.
Sure.
Not realizing that Frankenstein actually protects them. And, you know, so they kill Frankenstein, and then suddenly they're protected from other ravages.
Okay.
So the Frankenstein metaphor is just a metaphor here, of course. But
I guess maybe my question is less about Frankenstein and just like, how do we understand when the state itself is trying to do away with, like, when in neoliberalism, where the state is essentially doing away with itself?
Well, the way to think about it, it's not the state is, it's that there's political forces which capture significant segments of political power and are dismantling some aspects of the state. Now, not all. You know, the repressive apparatus of the state has been expanded tremendously, but that's perfectly consistent with neoliberalism. You know, repression is not intervention interior to the economy. It's repression to maintain social order. So the carceral state, as it's sometimes called, or the prison industrial complex, is part of the kind of neoliberal agenda. The key things, well, this would take us outside of the present discussion. The only point I wanted to make here is that if in the earlier period the state had developed a lot of capacity for intervention and regulation and was using that capacity both to help stabilize capitalism but also to respond to popular demands, both things were happening, and there was a feeling that the capacity had grown too strong and that the state was now becoming a drag on capital accumulation, the neoliberal response was to just have a wholesale, heavy-handed reduction of the state's role in the economy, but in ways which clearly has gone too far with respect to what produces economic stability. And then the question is whether or not there's going to be a capacity or a set of political forces capable of reestablishing this more interventionist or affirmative state. Yeah. You can go in then. Yeah.
Okay. I was going to say then, so how do we see political actors and their relationship to the state? Because it seems like if we're looking at, for instance, the government shutdown, they have a significant capacity to change the economic state of things. If they would have gone all the way to shutting the government down to the point where we went into like defaulting on loans.
Well, people can do stupid things. I mean, you know, agency is real. That's the whole point of the structure and agency kind of logic. There is a structure there that people are acting in and on, but depending upon the circumstances, they can act in ways which can have hugely destructive consequences. In the case, the way I think to think about it is that if the Republicans had, you know, had refused to budge, and we had defaulted, it's not the case that we would say that their purpose was to destroy the global economy and to produce 15% unemployment or whatever, you know, whatever the ramifications would have been of another meltdown, if that is what had happened. No, that was an unintended consequence of their strategy, and they were just acting stupidly. They weren't serving their fundamental interests. They were fixated with this idea of Obama being, you know, this great threat to everything they held dear, and they were prepared to take risks, and they believed the arguments. There were arguments being made 3 weeks ago on Fox News that the default wouldn't have been a big deal. You know, it was just scare tactics by the Obama forces and so on. So agency, just, I think all of it means just is that people can engage in strategies that are self-destructive.
I was hoping to follow up with a question then. So does that mean that this is sort of the autonomy part of, like, relative autonomy? Or should we see, that term as separate and just and talking specifically about the state? Or can we use that when we're talking about state actors?
So this is neither the autonomy part nor the... If anything, it's the non-autonomy part. That is, the non-autonomy part says that the actual people who make decisions matter. The autonomy part says the structures are designed in such a way to produce these effects, that the effects that are being produced does not depend upon the manipulation of actors. That's the non-autonomy part. I mean, the autonomy part says you don't have to look at who's pulling the strings to understand why the state does what it does. The non-autonomy part says you do have to look at who's pulling the strings, who the actual actors are, what their ties are, what their views are. That's what matters. And I think, as I've been saying, both are right. The fact that people in positions of power can make mistakes and do things which are destructive, not functional. They can do things which harm the reproduction of a system. So you can have, just to take another example, you can have in 1910, if you looked at the global development of capitalism and asked which countries are likely to be the leading economic countries a century later, Argentina would be on the list. Because Argentina was the fifth largest industrial power in 1910. It was way on the way to a dynamic accumulation process. But it had weak political institutions. It had institutions that were easily captured, that were used for patronage, that undermined the dynamic of its accumulation process. I mean, this is at least one. You know, I'm not an expert. This may not be the right way of thinking about the Argentinian case, but it's often invoked that there was huge amounts of British investment in Argentina. It was second to British investment in the United States. You know, railroads in the United States were financed by British capital, and railroads in Argentina were. It was really on the road to being an industrial powerhouse. And it was, roughly with respect to Latin America, it's sort of at the same latitude, kind of, as a lot of the United States is relative to North America. So, but it didn't happen. And there are lots of things which contributed to that, but it's often said that a weak state, a state without the capacity to do these things, and which then it lacked the capacity and it lacked the autonomy. There's a very fine book by Vivek Chhibber that's comparing South Korea and India in the 60s, 70s, through the 90s, asking why did South Korea go from a basket case? It was one of the poorest, most messed up, unpromising places in Asia in the 1950s. How come it could be this very strong industrial leading country by the 1990s? And again, it's all about the difference between a state that gets captured and is kind of in the pockets of leading capitalists versus a state that has autonomy, which enables it to discipline its capitalist class and to force them to engage in long-term strategies. It's essentially the argument. So those are structural arguments, but the structural arguments help you understand how agency works in those structures. That's why it isn't really should be thought of as structural versus agency arguments or structuralist versus instrumentalist. It's how a structural account helps you understand the instrumentalist processes. And a structuralist account without human actors is not going to be adequate, and an action-based agency account without structures isn't going to be adequate either. You really need both. Yeah?
So is the Frankenstein metaphor kind of the Polanyi argument?
Well, Polanyi's argument is about what happens when you don't have the Frankenstein. He wants Frank. I mean, he wouldn't. You know, he wants the strong interventionist capacity, and doesn't imagine it getting out of control. He's worried about the market getting out of control, that a market that's disembedded, that operates without adequate normative and legal constraints, ends up being very destructive. So that you have to re-embed the market, which is it's an elusive idea, but it's both re-embedding it in the kind of social fabric, but also in a set of political institutions. So that is creating the monster, the Frankenstein. He doesn't entertain, as far as I remember, the possibility that the state with those capacities gets out of control and starts harming the market. So he's more concerned with the problem of how the market harms the society if it's not properly constrained. The neoliberal concern is how the constraints harm the market if the constraints aren't constrained. And because it's so hard to constrain the constraints, better just to hunt down the monster and get rid of it. You know, that's the sort of neoliberal view of things. Get rid of the monster. Okay. All right. We should move on to the third contradiction. So the third contradiction is probably the hardest one to really fully understand. I was in looking over my notes. I thought, well, maybe I should just skip this because it's less clear, and I didn't have time to reread the Offie article to be sure that I was characterizing it properly. You know, these, as I've mentioned a few times, this temptation of after every time you teach a class to remind yourself, yes, I have to really thoroughly redo all this, and then you never get around to it. So I think it's worth me just briefly mentioning the character of this problem, but I'm not going to dig deeply into it, both for time constraints and because I'm not as sure that this is as important an issue as the other ones. But here's basically the problem. Different kinds of problems in the world. So I'm going to state this very abstractly to begin with. Different kinds of problems that need solutions are best solved through different kinds of decision-making processes. Different kinds of problems require different sorts of decision-making mechanisms in order for a rational solution to be found. Okay, that's just a general point. That's not specific to the problem of the capitalist state and how it deals with the problems of the economy. Basically, there are three kinds of decision-making processes available for state policy formation. And this is a general point that Offa makes that doesn't just apply to the capitalist state. It would apply really to any kind of state. These are three different logics of decision-making. Okay? So one kind of logic for rational decision-making is the classical Weberian logic. It's the bureaucratic procedure of the rational legal application of fixed rules. So one way that policies occur in the world is that you have a set of fixed rules, and then you create a bureaucratic machinery to apply those rules. That's the rational, legal, bureaucratic way of organizing the administration of state policy to solve problems, bureaucratic solutions. A second kind is what he calls technical rationality. This is not where you apply a rational legal set of rules. Rather, you ask experts to bring technical knowledge to bear to solve a problem. But the rules themselves don't specify the procedure. So an example would be you have the Environmental Protection Agency. The law, which sets up the rules, simply authorizes the Environmental Protection Agency to regulate, to create rules to regulate toxins in the environment. You know, to regulate how much mercury or how much lead can be dispersed by a production process into the environment. The law itself does not say how do you implement it, what the thresholds are, what the monitoring process is. I mean, none of that stuff gets specified in the law. The Environmental Protection Agency then hires a bunch of chemists and environmental engineers and other experts to formulate particular rules of implementation. And they engage in this sort of technical problem solving. That's pretty effective if you have very clear ends which are already specified, where the ends themselves don't need to be given further clarification. So if you have fixed ends, goals, then you can ask technical experts what's the best way of accomplishing those goals. So the goal is to reduce toxic levels in the environment below the threshold that's harmful to health. That's the goal. Well, then experts can tell you what that threshold is. They may get it wrong. You know, I'm not saying these are easy problems, but they know what it means to mobilize their technical knowledge to answer the question, what should the threshold be? And they can then say, look, there are these three different ways you could do it, and they can estimate the costs of the different ways. And all that involves bringing technical experts. That's what Offa calls technical rationality. The third type of policy formation problem solving requires what Offa refers to as democratic consensus formation. And this is the situation when the goals themselves are not clear. And there's no technical way of specifying what the what the nature of the problem to be solved is. And that's because of the complexity of the interests in play around a given issue, around a given domain of life, and the way in which you then decide what is the problem to be solved is through a process of participatory democratic consensus. Experts can't solve the problem. They can't establish the priority of interests. That requires a much more participatory and dialogic kind of problem-solving situation. Now, that kind of problem-solving process is the one that is the most inconsistent with the structures of a capitalist state. So structures of a capitalist state can accommodate bureaucratic problem-solving and technocratic problem-solving, but not dialogic problem-solving. This is then the dilemma of the contemporary situation. Bureaucratic problem-solving works when you have a fixed environment, so you can set up the rules once and for all, and then the bureaucratic administration simply applies the rules. Throughout much of the history of capitalism, bureaucratic decision-making worked pretty well. Many problems that involved creating the conditions for stable accumulation, you could do in that form. You create the rules and then you just apply them. Enforcement of property rights, regulation of contracts, the basic rules for the market, all of these things, you pretty much could specify in the law and then create a bureaucratic machinery to enforce and apply the rules. So bureaucratic decision making of the sort that Weber talks about worked pretty well, top-down command and control bureaucracy. The problem is that as capitalism developed technologically and spatially, the conditions for maintenance of capital accumulation becomes more and more complex, and strictly bureaucratic logic of action fails. Administrative application of predetermined fixed rules does not generate rational interventions. When people complain about red tape, that's essentially what they're complaining about, that the application of fixed rules is not doing the job well. Environmental regulation has this problem. If you create centralized fixed rules and simply apply them to every habitat, you make all sorts of mistakes. This occurs in all sorts of regulatory failures that are constantly being bemoaned. The problem is the alternatives to bureaucratic rule are also often unsatisfactory. For technocratic decisions, experts have difficulty in framing rational ends. They have competence to specify the means for unproblematically given end, such as profit making in capitalist firms, but they don't have competence and capacity to specify the ends themselves. Consider the problem of environmental regulation, where there's a deep tension between the short-run needs of maximizing profits and the long-term stability of the conditions for accumulation and the problem of the general well-being of people. Purely technocratic decisions applying technical expertise can't balance those ends. There's no principle by which expertise tells you how much weight to give to the welfare of people versus the long-term interests of accumulation versus the short-run needs of particular sectors. Purely technocratic decision-making makes it very difficult, if not impossible, to balance those kinds of ends. Democratic conflict consensus mechanisms, which is the alternative to technocratic decision-making, which is capable of discussing how much weight to give to different sorts of ends. This is an alternative, but it risks politicizing the goals of state action and calling into question the priority given to accumulation itself. And that's therefore the problem. You can't create a set of fixed bureaucratic rules that give priority to accumulation. you can't hand it over to technocrats to balance these different competing and conflicting ends, and you can't give it over to democratic consensus formation because that risks too much politicization. And so what tends to happen is there's an unstable shift, depending upon particular moments and context, across these different decision-making processes, none of which provide adequate functional processes of decision-making for accumulation. Well, as I said, this is the least clear, you know, of the four contradictory principles within the capitalist state. And what I've just presented is more of a gesture towards identifying the problem than it is fully elaborating it. Yes, Maddie.
Well, so the way that you described it, it seemed that the consensus was more of a way of identifying problems and less of a way of implementing solutions.
It's a way, though, of weighting the conflicting goals. So it's not just identifying the problem. We can identify there's a problem of environmental regulation. We have a problem of global warming. We have a problem of CO2 emissions, greenhouse gases. We have a problem of toxins in the environment. That's a problem. Everybody recognizes, or almost everybody, that these are problems. But that problem bears on a variety of different kinds of interests. And the question then is, what should be the goal of policy with respect to that problem? Should the goal of policy with respect to the problem of toxins in the environment be exclusively the health of people? Should that be the only thing that's considered? And everything else is ignored. So we just ask the question, what are the policies which would best serve the goal of improving the health of people? Or do we have to say, no, we have other goals too. We need jobs, and we need short-term competitiveness with other producers, and we need long-term stability of the conditions for accumulation. And how do you weight then the tensions between these different goals? There is no technical solution to that problem. So economists sometimes pretend that there is. That is, they try to make cost estimates of the value of a human life and say, well, a human life is worth, on average, $1.2 million. If they're old, they're worth a few thousand. If they're children, they're worth $3 million. So on average, it's $1.2 million per life. And it'll cost us $100 million to get rid of this toxin, and we'll only save four lives a year. So that's $4 million, and it's not worth it, right? You know, so, but that's a pseudo solution. It's not a real, it's not a real solution.
But then why can't you have, a democratically informed bureaucracy?
You could, and in an ideal world, that's what we would have. It would be a democratically accountable techno-bureaucracy. It would have all three of these, with the democratic principle being the one that defines the operation of the other two. But if you really infuse that with the capacity to produce a democratic consensus around these issues, you would risk the democratic consensus setting priorities that was not optimal for the functioning of capitalism. That's, you would risk the politicization of the process itself. Okay. I think we should leave that. Let me just briefly mention the fourth one, and then I think we should move on to the democracy theme itself. So the fourth contradiction is one that I think is fairly familiar. You know, it comes up a lot in political economic discussions. States have their capacity to regulate capital accumulation, to intervene in the interests of capital on specific territories. States are territorially bounded in their capacities for action, but capital accumulation is global. By saying capital accumulation is global, it means that capital flows globally beyond the boundaries of state jurisdictions. Yeah.
How do we account for military intervention that screws with economies of other countries?
Right, so imperialism is one of the ways that states intervene outside of their borders.
Okay.
Typically not to regulate capital accumulation. Mm-hmm. That is, okay.
So then how do we understand, say, British colonies?
Colonies, the colonial era was a case where states took the form of empires, where the states directly regulated the economic activities of territories outside of the metropole.
Yes.
In the contemporary world, we have emerging various global institutions like the World Trade Organization, in particular, the IMF in slightly different ways. We do have various global institutions which engage in global regulation of economic relations. And they have a certain state-like character, but it's pretty uneven and it's pretty weak and pretty limited compared to the regulatory actions that states do within their own territories. So the capacity of a state to regulate what's going on in its own territory, to regulate its monetary supply, to regulate its labor markets, is way greater than any capacity to regulate the equivalent things globally. And the point here, though, is pretty simple, that if capitalism needs deep forms of regulation in order for its contradictions to be contained, and if the agent, the apparatuses for doing that, are territorially bounded by and large, but the scope of action of capital accumulation is global, so there's a mismatch between the spatial scale at which the contradictions play out and the spatial scale at which they can be solved. There's a mismatch between those spatial scales. Then it becomes harder for the contradictions of capitalism to be effectively regulated by state intervention. The option of creating a global state, a global regulatory machinery that would actually be capable of regulating capital globally, has simply not been possible to create. So fragments of such global institutions are created. They often operate at cross purposes, and they do a pretty lousy job. You know, the global regulation of finance is very weak and inconsistent, and has a very difficult job actually accomplishing the regulatory objectives which are set to it. The global regulation of environmental issues is pitiful for the same kind of reasons. Yeah?
Well, what about like the World Bank and the IMF? Don't those sort of attempt to function as a mechanism?
Yes, sort of attempt to is, I think. I think sort of attempt to, yes. So there are emergent global institutions that do play this role. It's extremely clumsy. It's very hard to see that the forms of intervention which they've done are optimal for stabilizing global capitalism. They are capable of creating harm. You know, the austerity and restructuring orders by global institutions to developing countries with relatively weak states can cause tremendous harm. It's not so clear they can create global stability. So it's not that they have no global reach, it's just that they don't have global reach with the necessary competence to accomplish what a regulatory apparatus for a contradictory system like capitalism needs to accomplish. Yeah.
But like as globalization and it'll become more and more necessary for them to be able to accomplish like regulation and things like that. And so like wouldn't they like grow in the way that a state would grow?
So if you are a functionalist, that's what you would predict. So the functionalist argument would say that the structures of the system will adapt in time to the necessities of the system. The non-functionalist argument says that heavily depends upon contingent processes, and it may or may not happen. Think of, let's just think of the biological analog in evolution. If there's some severe change in the environment, you know, a comet hits the Yucatan Peninsula and the dinosaurs are threatened, the functionalist would say, well, the dinosaurs just have to adapt, you know, they're, and the, that's not how evolution works, though. The dinosaurs get extinct, and then suddenly mammals can develop, right? So the functional systems that have functional requirements do not necessarily change in order to have those functional requirements met. That requires conscious agency. In social contexts, the only way you're going to get a global regulatory apparatus is if the political forces are capable of producing it. And if the conflicts of interests across global capitalism are such, and if the political forces are only capable of mobilizing around short-term, not long-term interests, then you simply won't get the necessary apparatuses at the global level. So you'll have global instability with all of the ramifications and consequences of that without there ever being a solution. That seems to me more likely than that there'll be a stabilized global regime of capital accumulation with a capacity for global regulation.
Even if, like, capitalists see what's in their interest?
The thing is that American capitalists and Chinese capitalists will not see it in their interests in the same way, and they will not, and Russian capitalists and Ukrainian oligarchs, they all have such different interests with respect to how they extract surplus from the global system. And their question will be, in whose of our interests will this global state, this global regulatory regime really act? And the, you know, the general, I think, worry would be, there's no way to create a democratic process of accountability for this global state so that the different and conflicting interests of different groups of capitalists would have an arena to be reasonably resolved. And therefore, no sovereignty will be given to this global institution. It will remain perpetually weak on the statism kind of scale, statist scale, it will be an extremely weak state. So it will suffer from the same problems that the Argentinian state suffered from, so to speak, with respect to the requirements of intervention for its economy. It will not develop the competence and autonomy and power capable of doing the tasks which are required of it.
So the UN will fail?
Well, it may not fail in terms of one of its functions. So the question of whether you have global institutions that are capable of reducing the chance of war, for example, between powers because they engage in conflict resolution strategies, that's possible. So some functions can be done. The question is whether a regulatory apparatus for global capitalism is possible. And that seems to me pretty remote possibility, even if it's functionally desirable. And that's because of the heterogeneity of the interests of actors and the fact that institutions only get created when people actually create them. They don't just emerge because they're needed. People have to create them. And then people jockey, you know, the groups of powerful actors will be worried about what's in it for them and who are the winners and who are the losers. So just as it was very difficult to establish, and we only established it in a fairly weak way, a regulatory apparatus for national capitalism in the United States because of the capacity of different groups of powerful actors to block the development of such institutions, you know, in particular in the American context of Southern capitalists to block the development of national institutions out of fear that the national institutions would regulate them in ways that were disadvantageous. That problem is just writ large at a global scale. Yeah?
What about World Economic Forum in Davos or G8 or G20?
Yeah, so there are these fora, these places where, you know, the rich and powerful and their political representatives get together to discuss optimal policies, and some and weak consensus around things occur, but only in the sense of unenforceable goals. And even there, the consensus is pretty weak, because the difference between the needs and of particular parts of this very unevenly developed system are so different. Yeah.
I have kind of a weird question that may be hard to know, but I talked to this person that works in the U.S. Embassy in Honduras once, and he's saying that U.S. policy analysts, and I'm wondering with a question about the G8, if even just capitalists on a global scale, that they do Marxist analysis of reality in order to like best, you know, decide their strategies. Like they do like the same exercise that we're doing, but from their perspective, right? So like understanding reality in this sense, how do we best act for the benefit of the capitalist class? I mean, do you have, is that crazy? Or
well, if you're, as long as the word Marxist is being put in quotes, so it's meant slightly as a tease. They try to do systemic analysis where they look at contradictions. I don't think they're primarily concerned with questions of class struggle. They're much more concerned with questions of conflict between different segments of the capitalist class, the conflicts between finance and agriculture and industry. There's much more of a notion of there being global conflict around different kinds of capitalist interests in a contradictory whole than there is.
It's more an intra-class
analysis. It's much more of an intra-class analysis, is what I would say.
I mean, it's hard to know what they
do in
secret chambers, but
interesting
to think about.
Is
there any way out of this, and is there any way that we can actually maybe come to some sort of solution? Like, is there a possibility to have some sort of a real, like, good, like, UN type of thing, like G8 type of thing, that actually does what would ideally happen?
So there's two forms of answer to the question. one has to do with what kind of capitalism we live in, and the other is whether we have to stay living in capitalism, right? So in the spectrum of capitalisms that have occurred historically, some are much nastier than others. They all contain contradictions, they all have inequalities, they all involve exploitation, but some institutional configurations within which all of that happens make for much better lives for people. So Swedish capitalism at its best was way better than American capitalism for most people. So one question is whether or not on a global scale we could imagine a global capitalist system with global regulatory mechanisms that would move the global capitalism towards a Swedish type model. You know, so we'd have a kind of global, stable class compromise of a positive sort. I think that's pretty implausible, because the only way that that gets stabilized within countries is where there's very high levels of solidarity among the within the population to impose robust constraints on the strategies of capital, and therefore this positive class compromise becomes a good deal for capitalists, or at least the best deal that they can make, because it does stabilize their accumulation conditions, but on terms that are pretty favorable to ordinary people. That pretty favorable terms, though, really depends on the solidarity within the population, because it means in Sweden, and this is something people, you know, aren't so aware, in Sweden there was not redistribution from capital to labor. Very, at most, very, very modest redistribution from capital to labor. What there was huge redistribution within the working class between the most privileged and advantaged workers and everybody else. So wage inequality among wage earners was very flat. It was called the solidarity wage. But profit, you know, corporate income taxes, corporate taxes in Sweden are lower than the US. You know, they didn't tax capital. Their view was The basic settlement was, okay, capitalists, you make your profits and you keep your profits. Wage earners, let's make life as good as possible for all of us. And that means you privileged workers, you got to restrain your wages. Now, that's a solidaristic deal. It means that advantaged workers realized that their quality of life was actually enhanced by not pushing their advantages for all sorts of reasons. It made for a less conflictual society. It meant that the fears of unemployment, their security was higher. It meant that their children, they didn't have to worry as much about. You know, so I mean, one of the things that was always striking to me when I would visit Sweden and talk to my academic colleagues is if they had a kid who wasn't doing well in high school and was going to sort of drop out and get a job, they didn't fret about it. They said, okay, so he's not going to be a high-flying professional, but he'll have a perfectly good, or she'll have a perfectly good life. And that's because it just didn't matter so much. The stakes were much lower. Well, but to do that, academics had to get paid a lot less. And they were willing to do so, you know, in the stable period of social democracy. That was the deal. But that required very high levels of solidarity. It's pretty hard to achieve that even within a country. It's just, I think, unthinkable in the foreseeable future that you could have global solidarity among popular forces of that sort. You know, it's just, I mean, and that may be something fairly hardwired that therefore takes huge cultural effort to overcome. That is, that people are tribal in the sense of their solidarities are with people like themselves, and it's very tough to have distant solidarities that are robust, that aren't just symbolic. So I don't think that a global social democracy, you know, national social democracies are on the ropes. I don't think a global social democracy is feasible. But whether or not an exit from capitalism globally is feasible in some long term through alternative strategies of building alternative economic forms inside of the world in which we live, that's a different question. I think we should take our break, reconvene at 15:15, and we'll do a quick engagement with the problem of democracy and how it works.